shelves in the foyer, one for each apartment. We rarely received anything that wasn't a slim white bill or a thick brown packet covered in Amazon logos, so the small padded manila packet immediately got my attention. When had I last checked the post? I couldn't remember. Maybe Monday, when I'd gotten back from the talk at UCC, if even then. I pulled the packet out, turned it over in my hands. French stamps. Postmarked Nice 2 days ago. Tuesday, August 12th. A sticker with a tracking number and the word Priorité. Addressed to me in handwriting I didn't recognise. The packet was about the size of a slim paperback book, but I could feel something smaller than that through the paper. Something thin and hard sliding freely around inside. There was a pull tab on the flap. I tore it open, pulled one side of the packet toward me so I could look inside, and saw the wine-coloured cover of an EU passport. Slowly, using just my fingertips, I extracted it from the envelope. The passport had a harp on the front, above the word PA. It was an Irish one. I turned it over and opened it to the photo page. The image shook in front of me because my hands were shaking. I let the empty packet flutter down to the floor so I could hold the passport with both hands. By my right thumb, Sarah's face. By my left, a note in her handwriting. A sticky note, white, square, with some kind of blue logo at the top. Two small wavy lines centred. I didn't recognise it at the time. I don't think I had ever seen that logo before. Underneath it, three handwritten words. Well, two words and an initial. I'm sorry. S. I stared, disbelieving. And then I learned what weak at the knees really meant.
Part 2. Lost at Sea. Corinne. The cabin attendant's pre-shift meeting took place every morning at 7:30 in the crew bar. 50 or more cabin attendants assembled, all in uniform, navy and white dress with white tights for the women, navy trousers and white t-shirt for the men, white soft-soled shoes for everyone. All were chatting in various languages, all saying different versions of essentially the same thing, that they were not looking forward to work today. It was changeover when the couple of thousand passengers on board would leave the ship to make way for the couple of thousand new passengers who would start streaming onto it this afternoon. This meant checkout cleans, which were considerably more work than stayovers, and with boarding starting at 2, they had to happen in double-quick time. But Corinne rather liked the extra pressure. It meant there was less time to think. The crew bar had closed only a few hours ago, and the air still smelled of stale cigarette smoke and spilled beer. As Corinne picked her way through the crowd, she felt the soles of her shoes stick to the linoleum. "Changeover day, guys!" Michael, one of the accommodation supervisors, called out from the front of the room. He always spoke in English, the working language of the ship. A hush fell. "Everyone's favourite, I know," he continued. "Now," he glanced down at his clipboard, "we have a few issues today. The aft B elevator bank is only going as far as 12. We are still having an issue with the air conditioning on 6. I hear it's blowing warm, so probably best to leave it in the off position. Laundry had a breakdown with one of the ironing machines, so we're a little short on the double sheet with the piping." A groan rippled through the room. "Guys, come on. We can manage. And finally, whoever has the junior suites on 11, come see me. You've won a protein spill kit." A smattering of applause, but it was sarcastic. Protein spill was blue wave speak for a bodily fluid no longer in a body. 9 times out of 10, this meant vomit. The other time, The cabin attendant might well threaten to quit on the spot. Corinne collected her electronic master key and headed for the forward service elevators. One of them would take her to her charges, a cluster of exterior deluxe cabins built back-to-back near the bow on deck 10. Most attendants had cabins lined up one after another in a row, which meant walking to one end of them and then slowly working your way back. If, toward the end of your row, you encountered a DND, a Do Not Disturb sign, you had to walk the length of your section twice, going back to the DND later in the day. Corinne much preferred her tight loop of cabins. Better yet, they were right by a landing, the hidden area off the guest corridor, where attendance carts and supplies were stored, and where the service elevators stopped. Corinne was lucky in that regard. She might not have managed otherwise. These days, every little thing made a difference. She collected her cart now, a chest-high plastic storage unit on wheels. Every day it seemed to get heavier and harder to push. She used her key to open the small storage closet where the vacuum cleaners were kept and picked the one with the white stripe of correction fluid across the handle, the one that she knew worked for sure. Michael had promised a delivery of brand new ones, waiting for them at port today, but Corinne would believe it when she saw them. Supplies of everything were always limited. After a deep breath, Corinne hoisted the vacuum cleaner onto the hook at the side of the cart. She paused a moment to recover from the exertion, and then slowly pushed the cart as far as the first cabin on her list, Deluxe Superior number 1001. She rapped on the door, two firm knocks, waited a moment or two, listening for signs of life on the other side. Nothing. Confident the cabin was empty, she pulled her master key from the elastic cord clipped to her waistband and unlocked the door with a swipe. Following regulations, Corinne turned to pull her cart across the door behind her. This was so other crew members and passengers would know she was inside. Her eyes flicked to the strip of black plastic on the side of her cart and the raised white letters that read, Dupont, Corinne. At most, it was the size of a nail file, but to Corinne it might as well have been a giant flashing neon sign. Thousands of people were aboard the Celebrate. What were the chances that not one of them would recognize the name? Everything was on the internet these days, and then there were those documentaries, replayed and repeated on cable channels all over the world all the time. It was only luck that she hadn't been identified so far. How much longer would that luck last? Time was running out for her in more ways than one. She turned and went into the cabin, and her heart sank. There was rubbish everywhere. Empty water bottles overflowing the bin, discarded shopping bags lying on the floor, the remnants of what may have been a jam donut walked into and across the Celebrate's carpeting. The sheets hung off the bed, one of the pillows was out on the balcony, and every single towel, amenity, and toilet roll in the bathroom had been used. The occupants hadn't even bothered to flush the toilet before they left. Seeing this, and knowing how much energy she would have to find to clean it, Corinne felt a wave of exhaustion sweep over her. The strength went out of her legs. Putting a hand on the wall for support, she gently lowered herself into a sitting position at the end of one of the beds. She just needed a minute, 1 minute, and then she would get going. Corinne hadn't had any breakfast, which, she now realized, had been a mistake. But eating no longer appealed to her, and so she regularly forgot to do it. She couldn't even recall what having an appetite felt like. When she looked at food now, she just saw an inanimate object, like a book or a piece of furniture. But still, she had to eat. She had to stay strong for as long as it took. She glanced around the room, searching for a forgotten chocolate bar or a fizzy drink. Guests often left unopened snacks or drinks behind. Slowly and carefully, Corinne bent down to look under the bed. There was something under there, but it wasn't a forgotten bag of chips. With her foot, she nudged it out from under the bed. It was a photograph, lying face down, small and almost square, with white borders around black. A Polaroid. Hadn't they stopped making those? She straightened back up, turned the photo over. She couldn't comprehend what she was seeing. She blinked, looked again. It was a family portrait, its subjects arranged by descending height in front of a fireplace. A young husband and wife and two small boys. The mother had a baby in her arms. It had been taken on a Christmas morning many years ago. She knew this because she remembered it being taken. Corinne was sitting on the edge of a bed in Deluxe Superior number 1001, one of more than 1,000 cabins on the Celebrate, holding a photograph of her younger self. How is this possible? Her hands began to shake. She knew how it was possible. There was only one way. He was here. This was confirmation. He was here, and now he knew that she was, too. That evening, there was no sign of Lydia in the crew mess.
Adam. The next morning, Friday, Jack, Maureen and I met at Anglesey Street to file a missing persons report. Anglesey Street meant Cork's Garda headquarters, even though the city council offices, district court and a host of businesses all shared the same address. It was a sight I passed often but had never been inside. Garda HQ was an imposing grey block, sat on a corner, its design all no-nonsense symmetry. I imagined that the architect's front elevation sketch looked a lot like the houses you drew in crayon or built in Lego as a kid. A large rectangle with one big door in the middle and neat, evenly spaced rows of square windows on either side. And Gardaí, its headquarters warned, didn't have time for frivolous aesthetics. They had crimes to solve, criminals to catch. We waited in the reception area, an indulgence of stone slab flooring and natural light made possible by an atrium well hidden behind the no-frills facade. It was eerily quiet, like a cathedral. Watching TVs and movies, it turned out, was pathetically ineffectual preparation for what Irish police stations were actually like. Jack left Maureen with me while he went to the reception desk. Behind it, a male Garda, who looked as if he still had to show ID to order a pint of beer, stood flipping idly through a tabloid newspaper. He didn't look up as Jack approached, although he had to know he was there. But Jack, dressed for an early bird special and a night in the bingo hall, plaid shirt, shorts, socks and sandals, had shuffled up to the desk and was taking a second to smooth down the wisps of steel grey hair over his spreading bald spot. If I didn't know better, I would have guessed he was there to get a passport form stamped. That's probably what the Garda thought, too. "Good morning," Jack said. "I'm here to..." He faltered. "My daughter is missing."
Missing.
The word echoed around the chamber.
"Oh, God," said Maureen beside me.
Her hand was on my right arm, squeezing it, leaning on it. Unlike her husband, she had let her appearance drop right off her list of priorities. Her hair, blonde like Sarah's at the ends, grey at the roots, looked uncombed, and without her usual makeup, her eyes were small and sunken, the skin around them hanging slack in folds. The old cardigan she had thrown over her shoulders smelled faintly of something medicinal.
I didn't want to think what I looked like, not having slept much or shaved and still in yesterday's clothes. "It's okay," I said on autopilot. "It's okay." I had spent the night thinking, among other things, about what a strange concept a missing person was, at least the adult version of it. You could be fine, perfectly okay, even happy, but just because a selection of other people don't know your current location, you are a cause for concern, potentially for the police. Wasn't that odd? Wasn't that like saying it was against the law to leave us? Maybe it wasn't. Maybe it made perfect sense. Maybe it was just that I hadn't slept for longer than 30 minutes at a time in the past 36 hours. The cherub-faced guard came out from behind his desk and ushered the three of us into a conference room one floor up. Sunlight was streaming in the windows, slowly cooking the space. A wall of stale, hot air hit us the moment we crossed the threshold. Guard Cherub hurriedly pushed open the windows and dropped the blinds down halfway, leaving a waist-high sunbeam to illuminate the currents of gently swirling dust. We took three seats on the same side of the large table, the only ones in the shade. He offered us water from the dispenser in the corner, which came served in translucent plastic cups that caved and bent under our fingertips. These are the kinds of details you remember when you don't want to remember the rest. Someone would be with us shortly, Garth the Cherub promised. Then he left us there for half an hour. Sweat began to pool in the small of my back and in my armpits, gluing my t-shirt to my skin. The water from the dispenser was lukewarm. We didn't speak much while we waited, although Maureen did pray. I could hear the click of the rosary beads moving through her fingers, hitting the edge of the table from time to time. At one point, Jack got up and started to pace. I kept my phone on the table in front of me, in case Sarah called or texted. The charger for it was in my pocket in case the battery started to drain. Rose and Morsi were back at our apartment in case Sarah showed up there. The door opened abruptly and a female guarda entered the room, carrying a sheaf of documents and smiling brightly at us, as if we were there to talk to her about booking a sun holiday. "Garda Cusack," she said, reaching across to shake hands with each of us in turn. Her palm was damp. She took a seat on the opposite side of the table, facing us, blinking in the glare of the sun. "Hot out there today, isn't it? And there was me thinking that downpour last night would break the heat." She pulled a small leather notebook from a pocket and flipped it open to a clean page. A ballpoint pen was stuck inside it. She clicked it, saw that she had retracted the nib, and clicked it again. "So, I'm told you want to file a missing persons report?" Cusack was my age, I guessed. She looked like someone wearing a Garda uniform on a dare. Her yellow blonde hair was pulled into a half-arsed attempt at a ponytail, leaving wayward strands of it hanging limp around her face. She tucked one behind her ear now. Cusack was heavyset, or at least appeared to be, in her shapeless Garda blues. Navy wool trousers, cornflower short-sleeved shirt with epaulets, and chunky black leather belt with various pouches hanging from it. Her cheeks were bright pink, and a thin sheen of sweat glistened at her temples. "Our daughter is missing," Jack said. He had sat down at last. "We think she might be in some trouble. We called our local station yesterday, and they told us if we hadn't heard from her by this morning, we should come here first thing and make a report."
"We have pictures," Maureen said suddenly. "I brought some."
She started rooting in her handbag. "You'll need those, won't you?" I had the passport, the note, and the envelope they had come in stored carefully in a clear Ziploc bag. I took it from my jeans pocket and slid it across the tabletop toward Cusack. "This came yesterday." It was surprising to me how steady and normal my voice sounded when, underneath, anxiety was running amok through every vein. "It was delivered to our home. It's Sarah's. There's a note inside in her handwriting, but the handwriting on the envelope isn't hers. And she's not in France. She's in Spain. She's supposed to be, anyway. Barcelona. She flew there last Sunday, Possibly with... I glanced at Maureen and Jack. A friend. There was a beat of silence while Cusack just looked at us, moving from face to face in turn. Then, why don't we start at the beginning? She held a clicky pen over her notebook. What's Sarah's last name? O'Connell, we said in unison. Cusack directed her next question to Jack. And she's how old? 29, he answered. She'll be 30 in November. The 18th. Can I have your first names? I'm Jack, and this is my wife, Maureen. And you're O'Connell too, both of you? Jack confirmed they were. He seemed confused, as if he didn't understand how there could be any other option. Cusack looked at me. And you are?
Adam.
Dunn. I'm her boyfriend. We live together.
How long have you done that?
About 8 years.
Do you live locally?
On South Douglas Road, by the post office.
The apartment's in behind there?
Yes.
Is Sarah on any medications? Does she have a history of mental illness? Would you consider her to be a vulnerable individual for any reason at all?
I shook my head.
No.
Cusack looked to Jack and Maureen. They shook their heads too.
Has anything like this ever happened before?
All heads shook again.
Does Sarah have any brothers or sisters?
One older brother, Maureen said. He lives in Canada.
Have you spoken to him?
Yes, Maureen said.
He said the last time he heard from her was a fortnight ago.
She leaned forward.
Should we... I mean, do you think we need to... Should we ask him to come home?
I'm sure that won't be necessary, Cusack said. She flashed a quick smile, probably aiming for reassuring, but to me it seemed dismissive.
The passport, I said.
She can't travel without it, and it's postmarked Nice, in France. That's nowhere near where... Cusack held up her hand.
We'll get to that in a second. When did you last have contact with Sarah? Mr. and Mrs. O'Connell, why don't you go first?
She calls us every couple of days, Jack said, or texts. Maureen talked to her last Saturday morning, but there's been nothing since. We tried her on Monday, no answer. When we couldn't get through to her mobile, we rang her at work. That was Tuesday morning. More, was it?
Maureen nodded.
Now, I don't know who we spoke to at the office, but it was a girl, a young girl, and she said Sarah was out sick that day and the day before. So we called Adam, thinking he'd be at home with her, and that's when he told us that Sarah was in Spain. For work, a conference. She'd never said anything to us about going anywhere. And she would have. Of course, she would have.
Jack threw me a sideways glance.
Very unlike her, it was. Very unlike her. She flew to Barcelona on Sunday morning, I told Cusack, trying not to sound defensive. Jack seemed to be implying that there was a chance I was making this up. I dropped her at the airport. Well, she drove there and I drove back. I have brought a copy of the boarding passes. I took it out now and laid it flat on the table next to the Ziploc bag, which Cusack still hadn't touched, and swiveled it around so she could read it. I saw her go into the terminal. She sent me a text that afternoon, just after 4 o'clock, to say she'd landed and that she'd checked into her hotel. I know she withdrew cash from the ATM at Barcelona Airport.
How do you know that?
Cusack asked.
Her online banking. I checked it because I couldn't remember the name of the hotel she was staying at, but I thought she might have paid for it with her debit card, and so the name of it would be on there.
Was it?
There was a charge for incidentals. I got it from that. They take it on check-in, apparently.
Did she tell you that she hadn't told her parents she was travelling?
No, I assume she had.
You've tried calling her since yesterday lunchtime?
All three heads on my side of the table nodded.
Lots of times, Maureen said. I'm still trying. I tried just before we came in here.
Does it ring?
No, I said. It goes straight to voicemail. It did ring at first.
Does she have her charger with her, do we know?
I think so, I said. I haven't found it at home.
What about email, Facebook, things like that?
There's been nothing. No activity, no messages. I sent her some messages myself asking her to get in touch. I sent her a text using WhatsApp, which she hasn't read yet. When Cusack frowned, I added, there's a way to tell.
When did you send that?
On Monday.
Cusack looked down at her notes.
Also, I cleared my throat, she only stayed at the hotel for one night, the first night, Sunday.
And how do you know that?
I told Cusack about calling the hotel.
But she was due to fly back yesterday, Cusack said, nodding at the boarding pass printout.
Yeah, but she didn't. At least, I don't think she did. I didn't see her come through into arrivals, and I waited until everyone was off the plane. I checked that they were. Then when I got home, the passport was there with the note.
What does the note say?
It just says, I'm sorry, and it's signed with an S. I motioned toward the Ziploc bag. It's in there, stuck on the photo page.
Does that mean something to you? Does Sarah have something to be sorry for?
You said Sarah went to Barcelona with... Cusack looked at me pointedly. A friend?
Yes.
I shifted in my seat, hyper-aware of Jack and Maureen's presence. Rose and I had done our best the night before to explain to them that as far as we knew, Sarah had made a new friend, and that friend was a guy, and even though neither of us knew anything about him, not even his name, Sarah had gone to Barcelona with him. But I wasn't sure they understood exactly what we were saying, and I couldn't face the excruciating experience that double-checking would have been. Cusack looked from me to Jack, to Maureen, then back to me again.
You know what? She pushed back her chair. It's roasting in here, isn't it? I think we could all do with a nice cold bottle of water. I'll go get some. Wait a sec.
She stood up.
Adam, would you come and give me a hand with them?
Cusack walked out of the room, leaving Maureen and Jack staring after her, open-mouthed. Then they turned to look at me. Before they could say anything, I got up and followed her out. We crossed the corridor and went into another identical conference room. The only difference was that this one, mercifully, was dark and cool.
Okay, Cusack said, standing in front of me with her arms folded. Go.
I blurted out everything Rose had told me, ignoring the waves of shame and embarrassment that flooded my cheeks with colour.
So she was seeing another man,
Cusack said when I was done.
And they...
She nodded toward the room her Jack and Maureen were. Don't know that. Rose and I called over to them last night and tried to explain, but I'm not sure they got it. Or maybe they didn't want to get it. I think they think she just travelled to Barcelona with some guy from work, maybe for work. But then they did call the office. Look, I don't know. I threw up my hands.
No offence, but shouldn't we be doing something? Shouldn't we get out there and start looking for her? Call the French police? I mean, the passport, why would she send that? Why would she want to part with it? And if the handwriting on the envelope isn't hers?
The day she left, Cusack said. How was she?
Fine. I don't really...
Was she acting strangely?
Said anything weird? Did anything that made you wonder if something was wrong?
Not that I can think of, but we just got up and drove to the airport. The flight was around noon.
What about the day before that? That would have been Saturday. Think back. What did you do? Did you spend the day together?
We went out that night to a going away party.
What about the daytime?
I was at home. She went into town. She got a haircut.
A trim or a restyle?
What?
Did she just get it tidied up a bit, or did she completely change her hairstyle?
She changed her hairstyle.
Big change?
She went from long to very short. Why does that matter?
Did she take much luggage with her?
No, she only had a small bag, a cabin bag.
Did you see what she packed in it?
No. I could maybe make a list, though, see if I can tell what's missing.
What about a driving license?
It's in her wallet, usually, so she probably has it.
What did she tell you she was going to Barcelona for?
Work.
Can you be more specific?
A conference. She was there to attend a conference.
What does she do?
She works in recruitment. Anna Buckley. They have an office on the South Mall.
Has she ever travelled for work before?
No.
Did she seem excited about it?
I don't know. Not especially.
You didn't want to go?
I...
You can't afford to. You need to work.
No, I mean, I couldn't.
You said she made a withdrawal from an ATM in Barcelona.
Yeah, at the airport.
Of how much?
It was an odd figure, 650 something, I think.
Did you check her credit card?
She doesn't have one. She just uses her Visa debit.
How long have you been together?
10 years.
Why aren't you married?
Well,
because we never made plans to do anything beyond waiting a bit longer for my dream to arrive. Because, as Rose had so kindly pointed out to me, I never thought of anyone except myself.
How is that relevant?
How about her friends? Cusack asked, ignoring my question. Have you spoken to them?
Rose is her best friend, and she hasn't heard from her.
Work friends?
I haven't spoken to anyone in the office. I figured your crowd would do that.
My crowd? The Gardaí, I mean.
Is she pregnant?
What? No.
Was she?
No, never.
Women go abroad, Adam. Sometimes things go wrong. Procedures take longer to recover from than they should.
This isn't that.
You're sure?
Positive.
What was your relationship like?
It is great, I said defiantly.
So you don't believe she was cheating on you with this other man?
I don't think there's any point in believing anything until I've had the opportunity to talk to Sarah first. But we can't make contact with Sarah, and we don't know where she is. That's why we're here. We're here so you can help us find her, which I'd really like to start...
What does Rose think?
About what?
About where Sarah is.
She thinks... She says that Sarah would never have not come home.
Has Rose ever met this man, the American?
No.
Does she have reason to believe he may have hurt Sarah in any way?
I don't think so, I said, trying not to follow the phrase, reason to believe he may have hurt Sarah down the rabbit hole, the same rabbit hole I've been circling since I found the passport and the note.
Does Sarah keep a diary? Cusack asked.
Not that I know of, no.
Do you have access to her emails?
I don't know the password.
But you knew the password for her online banking.
That was written down, it came in a letter.
Tell me, if I asked you to provide me with evidence that this American man exists, would you have anything that didn't come from Rose? Or if I asked Rose the same question, would she have anything that didn't come from Sarah? For instance, has Rose ever seen this American man? Is she friends with him on Facebook? Ever heard Sarah on the phone to him?
Rose doesn't even know his name, I said. She said Sarah felt bad talking about it.
What about when...
Wait, I said, there is something.
The middle seat.
On the boarding pass.
Sarah booked a middle seat for her outbound flight.
I think because she wanted to sit next to whoever had already booked the aisle or the window.
Why do you think that?
Because who wants to sit in the middle?
Cusack frowned, considering this.
What do you do? She asked me.
For a living.
I'm a writer.
A writer? Really?
What do you write?
I lifted my hands, let them fall again.
Does it matter?
No, I suppose not. Cusack
cocked her head, indicating the corner of the room behind me. There's a fridge over there. Grab a few bottles of water and let's go back. Back in the first conference room, Jack was pacing again. I doled out the bottles of water, but no one opened theirs. Cusack and I resumed our seats at the table. After a beat, Jack did too. Maureen had spread the photo she brought of Sarah out on the tabletop. Cusack looked at them briefly before collecting them into a stack, which she slid beneath her notebook. None of those photos looks very much like Sarah does now. The thought shot through me like an electrical current. Was that why Cusack had asked about Sarah's hair, about whether it was a big change or not? Was that why Sarah did it? To disguise herself somehow? To make herself harder to find? I almost laughed out loud at the idea. Sarah, thinking ahead to a situation where her parents would be sitting in a Garda station reporting her missing and cutting all her hair off in order to prepare. The same Sarah who cared enough to handwrite relevant quotes into every greeting card she sent. The same Sarah who always offered to make tea at the point in the Shawshank Redemption where Brooks doesn't do too well for himself on the outside because she couldn't stand to watch bad things happen to kind old men. The same Sarah who, after starting a tradition for us of birthday breakfast in bed, rolled up copies of Empire magazine and folded back the page corners on one end to make a flower to put on my tray to match the single sunflower in a vase I always put on hers. No, it wasn't possible. The haircut must have been a coincidence. But then, what did the passport and the note mean? Here's what we're going to do, Cusack said. I understand that you're concerned that you haven't been able to get in contact with Sarah these past few days. I don't blame you. But technically, Sarah has only failed to be where she was supposed to be for less than 24 hours. I need you to understand that in my line of work, we encounter situations like this all the time, every week. And you know what? 9 times out of 10, we don't have to take any action because before we can, the person makes contact or returns home. And what about the 10th time? Maureen asked. Not hearing, or else ignoring her, Cusack pressed on. It can be difficult, I know, to understand why someone would choose not to make contact with their friends and family, but sometimes people just need a break, or they think they do. Or it could be something else entirely, something innocent. A misunderstanding. A lost phone and a missed flight. You never know, Sarah could think she booked Friday instead of Thursday, and in a couple of hours she'll come walking through arrivals up at the airport, wondering where her lift is. She could have lost that passport and, not knowing that a good Samaritan has already returned it for her, be in a queue at an Irish embassy right now, waiting for an emergency travel certificate so she can fly home. I could feel it, my side of the table sinking into the bliss of those explanations, pulled into the idea of this all being over by the end of today, gone, with no harm left in its wake. But if any of those things were true, why hadn't she called to let us know? How would a good Samaritan know her home address? Where did a note in Sarah's own handwriting fit in? What about the middle seat? The one night in the hotel, calling in sick to work, but telling me she was travelling because of work. Regardless, Cusack continued, Sarah is an adult. She's 29 years old. She's perfectly within her rights to go where she wants, when she wants, without informing everyone or anyone of her intentions. There's a common misperception about missing person investigations. A missing person isn't just someone who can't be located. It's someone who can't be located and for whom there is a genuine fear or concern regarding their well-being or the company they are known to be in. I see no cause for that here, at least not at this point. I also have to tell you that some of the actions she's taken could be construed as preparation for leaving. If that's the case, if she has left intentionally, then even if we did find her, we'd have to get her permission before we could let you know we had.
If? Jack repeated. You are going to look for her, aren't you?
Maureen said, lurching forward in her chair.
We can't do it ourselves. We don't...
She looked around, panicked.
We wouldn't know how. We don't even know where to start.
Here's what we're going to do, Cusack said. And I noted that this was the second time in 2 minutes she had said those words, and we still didn't know what we were going to do. I recommend that you go home, continue trying to make contact with Sarah through any channels you can think of, phone, friends, Facebook, and so on, and let us know if you hear anything from her. You can use our telephone number here for the contact information if you wish. I'd recommend that you do. Don't put your personal phone numbers on anything you plan to post online. In the meantime, I'll liaise with the Department of Foreign Affairs. See if Sarah has made contact with any of our European consulates. I can also check whether or not she was on that inbound flight yesterday. Perhaps she was and you missed her, Adam. If nothing changes, we'll reconvene here on Monday morning and see where we go from there.
I thought, reconvene here on Monday? Is there really a possible version of this universe where another 2.5 days go by without us hearing anything from Sarah?
Cusack started collecting her things but didn't touch the Ziploc bag or the printed boarding pass.
Don't you want to take those? I asked.
Why don't you bring them with you on Monday, if we meet then?
The CCTV, Jack blurted out. You could check the CCTV at the hotel.
We'll definitely talk about that, Cusack said. On Monday.
I can't wait until then. Maureen's voice sounded so small it pierced me. I need to talk to her now.
She looked at Jack.
I need to talk to my daughter now.
Jack looked at his wife, helpless. He watched as she started to cry. Then his lower lip began to tremble. I looked to the opposite wall. I couldn't watch. The normal world, the before world, was slipping away, sliding toward a position that would soon be beyond my reach. The abyss wasn't just stretched out in front of me now. It was all around me, above and below me, and I was falling, tumbling down, down. And what could I do about it? At that moment, I couldn't think of one single thing. Out of desperation, I picked up my phone and called Sarah's number, even though I knew what I would hear. A beat of dead air, and then her voicemail kicking in.
For fuck's sake, Sarah! Turn on your damn phone! Or call us from another one! Just do something! End this! Make it stop!
I opened WhatsApp then, and... What the... I kept my expression neutral, my face a blank mask. Brought the screen closer to my face, blinked, looked again, made sure it was really there, made sure that my despair hadn't built a hallucination. A double check mark where I'd been expecting only one. The message I'd sent to Sarah on Monday. It had been read. I mumbled goodbye to Jack and Maureen, telling them that I had something to do and that I would call them afterward. They just looked at me blankly. I made my way back down to the lobby of District HQ, out into the morning sun and into the first place I found where I could sit and think, the bar across the street. Inside, it was empty and cavernous, the lunchtime rush a while away yet. I asked the bartender for a whiskey. It felt like liquid heartburn going down, and then acid indigestion once it had, but soon my edges began to blur and my senses retreated a step. I felt a little better. I ordered another one. I felt better still. The bartender was studying me, not realizing that I could see him in the mirror mounted behind the bar. After my second one, he asked me if I was okay, said he'd seen me coming out of the station. I wondered whether they always kept such a watchful eye out for customers who had come from a chat with Ungartha Shiakana, and whether he did that because sometimes they had trouble with the ones who had. I said I was fine and asked for another one. The bartender said he'd bring me something to eat instead. I sent Morsi a text to tell him the Gardaí would be no help. He asked me where I was. 15 minutes later, he climbed onto the bar stool beside me. He must have left Tyndall the moment I texted back, or run all the way here without breaking a sweat. "Weren't you at work?" I asked him. "Yeah, but it's fine." He asked the bartender for a Sprite. "They pretty much let us come and go as we please over there." "Do they?" I drained what was left of my second drink, fixed my eyes on the empty glass. "Even when you have a big project deadline, like you do today." Morsi was silent while the bartender set a bottle of Sprite and a glass filled with ice cubes down on the bar in front of him. "You knew, didn't you?" I said as soon as we were alone again. I turned to face him. "You knew Sarah was seeing that guy. That's why you were being weird. I thought you were jealous or something, or annoyed with me because I was being a dick. Is everyone telling me lies, Morsi? Can I trust anyone at all?" "Ad look." Morsi sighed, but he wouldn't look at me. "I'm sorry, okay? But I only found out by accident. I overheard Rose on the phone to Sarah. I didn't even tell her for ages, and when I did, she freaked out. She said if you found out, it'd all be her fault, not mine. Anyway, Ad, I didn't really believe anything was going on. I mean, Sarah? You and Sarah, the golden couple? I didn't think there was a chance. Even now I'm thinking there has to be some simple explanation for this." "She read the message," I said, turning back to my now empty glass and the plate where only the crumbs of a ham sandwich remained. I pushed both away. "The WhatsApp message. Its status is red now. She's seen it." "What? When?" "The timestamp is from when I sent it. You can't see what time it's read." "Can you figure it out? When did you last check it?" "I know I opened WhatsApp last night when I was at Jack and Maureen's house. The message wasn't read yet, I'm sure of it. But when I looked just now, well, about half an hour ago, the double check mark had appeared. So it must have happened overnight. Considering that the phone must have been on for her to do it and that all the calls we made went straight to voicemail, it never rang, that makes sense. She turned the phone on either very late at night or very early in the morning, so she could check her messages but not alert any of us that the phone was on."
"Shit, Ed.
That means she..."
"Read all the texts I sent her. The ones Rose and her parents sent her too. Maybe even listened to the voice messages, checked her emails, but didn't bother responding to any of them. And didn't bother contacting her mother and father either, even though I sent a text saying we were going to the Gardaí." I got the bartender's attention and pointed to the coffee machine. My head was starting to feel as if it was encased in a fog. "It means she left on purpose. With him. That she did this to us. Is doing it. What did the Gardaí say?" "She's a grown woman. Come back Monday."
"What'll they do then?"
"Well, not much, judging by the reaction today. They've told us to go home for the weekend and put her picture up on Facebook and Twitter, that kind of thing. We could have figured that out by ourselves."
"They know she read the message?"
I shook my head.
"No."
"Did you tell Jack and Maureen?"
I shook my head again.
"Ad, you need to tell them."
"Why? What good would it do? Hey, you know this horrific waking nightmare we're all going through? Well, good news. Sarah orchestrated it all by herself. Your daughter did this to you. You're welcome."
At least they'd have the comfort of knowing that she's alive.
"Alive?" I scoffed. "Of course she's alive."
"Yeah, but Jack and Maureen, I bet their imaginations are running riot. They're probably lying awake all night picturing the worst. If you told them she'd read the message, they'd still be lying awake all night, wondering why Sarah did this to them."
We lapsed into silence for a while.
But what about the passport? Morsi asked. Aren't the Gardaí concerned about that?
The Garda we spoke to said that maybe Sarah lost it and is at this very moment standing in line in an embassy somewhere getting emergency papers so she can fly home.
But who sent the passport to your place?
A good Samaritan, apparently, who was also a psychic, because that's the only way they could have known Sarah's home address.
Isn't this a good thing, though? Morsi asked. That they aren't springing into action. That they don't seem that worried about her. That makes me think they hear stories like this all the time, but the people come back.
What if she doesn't come back, though? How are we ever going to find her if we don't have their help? Where will we go from there? How can I...
My words caught on the lump in my throat.
How can I just go on with my life without knowing where Sarah is, or how she is, or why she did this? I can't even sleep without knowing, let alone...
How do you expect me to live in that apartment, or go buy milk at the store, or write, Jesus Christ, write, without knowing where she is? What do I do with her stuff? What if I move on, and then she changes her mind and comes back? What if she's sick, like mentally ill or something? And this is not a decision she's made, but some kind of episode she's suffering from, and she needs our help. We can't help her if we don't know where she is. We don't know what's happening if we can't talk to her. What if we're still here a month from now, none the wiser? Or in a year? 10 years? I haven't even told my parents yet, Morsi. I don't know how. How do I start that conversation? Where are the instructions for living like this?
Morsi put a hand on my arm.
At least you know she's okay, though, he said gently. If she checked her phone, she must be okay.
But why is she doing this? Why won't she just call me and talk to me? If she wanted to leave me and go off with this other guy, why didn't she just break up with me?
My coffee arrived. I lifted the cup with both hands and took a sip very slowly. It was a chance to pull myself together.
What about the American? Morsi asked.
What about him?
Have you thought about trying to contact him? He might be easier to get to. He might have his phone on for a start.
How would we get his number? I asked. We don't know anything about him. We don't even know his name.
The prospect of talking to him, to the faceless American, gave me heartburn worse than the whiskey did. I didn't want to know anything about him. I preferred him as an idea, a faceless threat, a possible misunderstanding. But if I could reach Sarah through him...
There has to be a way, Ad, Morsi was saying. Think, if you were looking for evidence that she had been in contact with someone, where would you go?
To her phone, I said, which we don't have, her email account, which we can't access, her wallet, which she took with her.
Did you look at home? Through her drawers and stuff. Rose has this big hat box thing where she keeps mementos and souvenirs and crap, receipts. Does Sarah have anything like that?
I don't think so, no.
Is there anywhere else she'd keep...
He stopped just as I spoke. We'd both thought of it at exactly the same time.
Her desk, I said. Her desk at work.
It took us 5 minutes to walk from Anglesey Street to the doors of Anna Buckley Recruitment. It occupied an entire Georgian building on the South Mall, across from the majestic limestone columns of the AIB bank building that sat at number 66. I went to reception and asked for Susan Robinson while Morsi waited on the street outside. They directed me upstairs. Susan was waiting for me outside her office door.
Adam!
She pulled me in for a hug.
I asked Lisa to double-check the name. I was like, Adam Dunn, Hollywood screenwriter, Adam Dunn. Are you sure? What are you doing here? We never see you around these parts. Come to pick up Sarah's homework, have you? Is she feeling better? Nothing worse than stomach flu, is there? I suppose you tend to lose a couple of pounds at least. Maybe I should get her to lick me or something. I've a christening next week. Ha! Come on in, come on in. Have a seat.
I did what I was told. I was exhausted already. But I did have confirmation that Sarah had indeed called in sick. Susan was in her late 40s and making every effort to hide the fact. Today, she was wearing a short, shiny, shapeless dress with some sort of geometric design printed on the front, towering heels that poised her feet at the same angle as Barbie's, and thick, black eyeliner that I could see pooling in the inner corners of her eyes from 3 feet away. Her legs and arms were the same odd rust colour, and her white blonde hair didn't move when she did. I wondered idly how flammable she was. "Saturday night was fun, wasn't it?" she said. "God, I didn't get home until after 3. The babysitter was a right bitch about it. I gave her an extra 20, though, and that soon put the train track smile back in her face. €60 she went home with. Can you believe that? She makes more than me if you go by the hour. We should all be babysitters, huh? I was lucky to get a pack of chips and a fiver when I was hurt."
"Susan," I said, "Sarah isn't sick." A moment of suspended animation as she stopped chattering in mid-sentence. A flicker of confusion crossed her face. Then,
"She's feeling better, you mean?"
"No. She was never sick."
"Then why..."
"I'm sorry, Adam."
Susan laughed nervously. "I think I'm a bit lost here."
"Sarah just told you she was sick. She actually went to Barcelona. She flew out there Sunday morning and was supposed to come back yesterday lunchtime, but she didn't. She wasn't answering her phone, and now it's switched off. No one has heard from her. Not her parents, not her best friend, not me."
"Well, I'm sure it's just..."
"We went to Anglesey Street this morning, her parents and I. We've reported her missing."
Susan looked stricken. "But she said she was sick."
"When did she tell you that, exactly? Do you remember?"
"She emailed me over the weekend. Sunday morning. I remember because I thought to myself..."
Susan blushed.
"I said to myself, she seemed perfectly fine on Saturday night. God, I thought she was just hungover. I mean, it's not like I could blame her. I was dying myself Sunday morning."
Had I seen Sarah typing a message on her phone at any point on Sunday morning?
I didn't think so,
but then she'd been at the airport early. She could have done it there. I tried to picture her face as she composed the lie to Susan, read it over, and pressed send, but I got only a collection of blurry, indistinct features where Sarah's face should be. I couldn't picture it. I couldn't believe my Sarah would do that. But she had.
"Have you heard from her since?" I asked.
"No."
"Is she okay? Is she feeling okay? I mean, like..."
Susan pointed to her head.
"Mentally?"
Ignoring that, I said, "Do you think anyone else here would have heard from her?"
"I don't know. I can ask. Whatever we can do to help, Adam, whatever we can, just say the word."
"Would you know anything about an American man that Sarah might have met through work, that she became friendly with?" I focused on a spot of bulletin board just over Susan's left shoulder while I said it, but she didn't reply until I made eye contact again.
"An American man? Why? Do you think they're... are they together?"
"Do you know anything about that?" A creeping flush was heading for my cheeks. The leading edge of it was the embarrassment of asking if other people were aware long before I was that my girlfriend was cheating on me. The rest was the shame of being embarrassed about anything when the reason I asked was because I didn't know where Sarah was. "Did you have any training days where someone came in from outside the company, or visits from other branches? How could she have met someone at work who didn't work here?"
"I don't..."
"Adam, what's going on? Can I take a quick look at her desk?"
"Her desk?
There might be something in there that will help us contact her.
Like what?
I won't know until I find it.
Susan looked flustered. I don't know.
It's okay, I said. Just thought I'd ask. Probably better to leave it for the Gardaí anyway. I think you can expect a Monday, they said.
They're coming here.
Well, they need to search her desk. I could see the conflict on Susan's face. Gardaí swarming around the office would be exciting, yes, but the workday would also be completely disrupted while Sarah's colleagues huddled together to gossip and theorise.
I suppose it'd be okay, she said.
Can I go look now? I pushed back my chair. Her parents are freaking out, as you can imagine. The sooner we make contact with her...
Of course, yeah.
Susan stood up. Follow me. We took the stairs down to the ground floor and walked toward the rear of the building and out into a modern extension. An office space filled with fluorescent lights, grey cubicles and young workers in off-the-rack suits sitting at desks. They all looked up as we walked in. Susan shot them a collective stern look. Turn back around. Get back to work. Mind your own business. I followed her to the back of the room to a desk by a large window.
This is it, she said.
The desk wasn't in a cubicle, but backed up to another desk so that Sarah sat facing her co-worker. There was no one sitting opposite now, but a half-full cup of coffee and this morning's examiner spread open across the desk suggested that someone had been recently and would soon resume doing so. On her desktop sat a large computer screen and a phone and some stationery, a pen pot, stapler and notepad. There were no personal items, no clue that this was Sarah's desk.
She's very tidy, Susan said, very neat.
I pulled out the chair and sat down, eyeing the three drawers by my left leg. If I was going to find something, it would be in there. It felt weird, sitting in this place where Sarah spent most of her time. A place I'd never seen before. Pictured, yes, and heard about in great detail, but never actually seen for myself. A huge part of Sarah's life took place in this room, a part that I knew only from the bit she decided to share with me. But did I really know it? Had she told me everything that mattered? Were other secrets hidden here? Susan was looking down at me with her arms folded across her chest. I'll just be a second, I said.
Oh, right. I'll wait over by the door. Holler if you need anything.
I waited for Susan to walk away before I opened the top drawer and immediately saw why Sarah managed to keep such a neat desk. It was filled to the brim with junk. I poked through it. A couple of blank note cards, a jar of paper clips, a Leap bus card, a pocket calculator, a pack of chewing gum, a crumpled tissue, a pair of cheap sunglasses, an espresso club catalogue, a pair of headphones, a pendant I hadn't seen her wear in ages and that now had a tangled knotty chain, an appointment card for a hair salon. I pulled out the appointment card. Lane Casey Design. A salon I had a vague recollection of seeing somewhere in the Huguenot Quarter, maybe on French Church Street. A time and date were handwritten on the card. 11:30 a.m., Saturday 9th August.